Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. Hey, listen, I'm going to bring these CDs back to my home group, so would you do me a favor? My name's Chris. I'm an alcoholic. All right. Thank you. Hey, I want to thank Jeff. I want to thank the committee. It takes a ton of work to put something like this on. And I really appreciate being in this hallowed ground of Akron, you know, the birthplace of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a special experience for my wife and I. You know, I did say I'm an alcoholic. I understand a little bit about what that is today. I think when I was suffering from it and, you know, my first months in Alcoholics Anonymous, I misunderstood it. And because I misunderstood it, you know, I was really working on the wrong problem. I was trying to address the alcohol. Now, you know, from the very beginning, I got that I drank a little bit more than the people that I was around. I understood that. I understood that I got in a lot of trouble with it. But to understand that I was powerless over it is just not something that I could compute. And that caused me a lot of problems. I believe alcoholism today has a spiritual component, a very big spiritual component. I believe it's emotional. I believe it's genetic. It's a very, very unorthodox illness, alcoholism. It's misunderstood by practically everybody. I mean, there are alcoholism experts and there are treatment experts that misunderstand it. It's an unorthodox illness. And you know, I started to suffer from it very, very early on. I heard a speaker this morning talk about kindergarten, and I had the same kind of experience. When I showed up at school, I felt something was like really wrong. There were all these other kids all over the place, and it just didn't seem to be okay with me. And I felt really uncomfortable, and I started immediately to worry about, you know, what are they going to think of me? You know, what am I going to look like? And I started to get what you would probably diagnose today in a six-year-old, an anxiety disorder. I just felt really, really uncomfortable. And it was very difficult for me to do a lot of things. And of course, I kept this all inside. I didn't talk about it with anybody because I felt like there must be something wrong with me. There must be something different about me. You know, why can't I deal, you know, with this? And so I went through a number of years of school just acting as if, you know, I wasn't scared to death. Just kind of, you know, not being completely honest and just trying to do the school thing. And one day, I think I was in eighth grade. One day, me and a couple of my friends decide that we're going to cut school and we're going to go back to my house and we're going to get drunk. You know, we'd heard about this getting drunk stuff. We saw a lot of it on, you know, John Wayne movies. It just looked like it would be really cool to do. So that's what we did. We cut school. We went back to my house, and what I did was I pulled a bottle of Four Roses whiskey off the shelf, and I poured three big water glasses for me and my two buddies. Now, it's not how you drink Four Roses whiskey warm and in a big water glass. I'd learned that, you know, about 6 hours later. But I poured out these glasses. Now, I want to tell you what happened with the two guys, how they reacted, because I think that's as important as how what happened with me. I passed them the two glasses, and I had a glass, and they started drinking, and they drank about two-thirds of the glass, and then they shoved it back, you know, and they said, "That's enough for me." You ever drink with people that do that to you? You know, "No more for me, thanks. I've had enough." Are you crazy? What do you mean, enough. What is enough? So they push their glass back and they watch the show. Because what I did was I drank my whole glass, I finished off their glasses, I drank as much of the bottle as I could, and I went into my first blackout. I'm like 13. Any blackout drinkers in here? It's amazing, right? It's like time travel. You ever like come to in the future, handcuffed in the back of a cop car or something, you know? Like, whoa! How did I get here? So I had my first blackout, and I came to in a field. I'm in a field. What am I doing in the field? And I stagger back into my house, and I'm as ill as you can be for like 2 days. You know, your first real drunk hangover or alcohol poisoning or whatever. And I had to be horizontal. I'm vomiting. It's a mess. I feel like I'm going to die. And the whole time I'm thinking, I'm going to do this a lot. Now think about that. Why would I say something like that? I've just poisoned myself. The reason I said that was because that really anxious, repressed, adolescent, that I was always worried about stuff and not feeling right and always wanting to leave and never feeling comfortable enough to talk to people and all this. When I started drinking that alcohol, I got to tell you, the best way I can describe it is like this. This is how I felt while I'm starting on my second glass of Four Roses whiskey. All of a sudden, everything that was wrong was right. All of a sudden, all the fear and the anxiety is gone. And I'm with my two best friends, and this is the best place to be, and this is great. And I remembered that feeling. It was the first time I felt completely free and at ease. And the alcohol did that to me. And I noticed that. So I also noticed that you probably shouldn't drink half a bottle of warm Four Roses whiskey. I was smart enough to notice that. But I knew that I had to start using this alcohol, whether it was conscious or unconscious. I had to start using this alcohol because it did something for me that I needed to have done. And I'm 13. The drinking age is 21. It was problematic, but not insurmountable. You had to work at getting people to buy you alcohol. And, where were you going to drink it? Who were you going to drink it with? And I started to become very, very preoccupied with that. And then, I'm not going to touch that Canadian whiskey anymore, but there was some alcohol that, kids were drinking. There was a company that had a fine catalog of products, Boone's Farm. Anybody remember that crap? Oh, my God. It's like Strawberry Hill and apple wine. It was just torturous stuff. So I started to drink that. And there was some other alcohol like blackberry brandy and Southern Comfort and things like that that 13-year-olds were drinking. And I started to drink all that stuff. And I started to use it as a tool. If I'm going to be stepping out, if I'm going to be going to a party, if I'm going to be going to a dance, anything like that, I'm going to approach it with confidence. So I'm gonna have a little bit of alcohol before I move forward with that. And I started to do that. And right from the get-go, alcohol started to cause a lot of problems with me. I got my driver's license, and probably in the first year of having my driver's license, I had a couple of car crashes. It's funny. I'm the type of drinker who, I'll come to and I'll pull the summons out of my back pocket for uh, for a DUI, and I'll say to myself, I gotta stop driving. You know, it's like alcohol was so ingrained in what I did. You know, people would ask me questions like, "What? You know, why do you drink so much? Why are you always drinking?" And that was a really, really difficult question to accept. You know, you had to deflect that. But it was ingrained in me. Now, from the get-go, I was a blackout drinker, and what that looked like, I'll describe a normal day in the last, say, 4 years of my drinking. I would come to in the clothes that I had passed out in the night before. And I would stagger into the bathroom, you know, and I'd get ready for work, and I'd go out to my $100 car and go off to my terrible job. And you know, and the whole time my head would be pounding, and I literally would be poisoned by the alcohol. It wasn't really a hangover. I was maybe 130 pounds soaking wet, and I would drink a fifth of vodka or something. You know, you're poisoned if you do that. So, you know, I'd get out into my car, and I'd start driving to my terrible job, and I'd just be shattered. And I would say to myself, you know, I get it that this alcohol is just about killing me. I understand that. And today is the day I'm going to give up drinking. Today's the day. Now, here's the funny thing. If you had a lie detector and you strapped it on me and you said, Chris, are you going to give up alcohol today? I would say, yes, today is the day I'm going to give up alcohol. And the needle would go right to true because I really did mean it. I meant it with everything I had. But what would happen is it'd be about lunchtime and, you know, I'd get half a sandwich down. I'd be rehydrated. It'd be about 3 o'clock in the afternoon and quitting time is coming. And I'd start to think, you know that decision you made early in the morning about never drinking again ever? You know, that might be an overreaction. You know, we might have to think about this. We might have to reassess this whole thing. And what I would do is, by the time I'm driving home, you know, I would go right to the liquor store. So my drinking career spanned about 19 years. In the early days, I got to tell you, there was some fun. In the last several years, there really wasn't. It was more like a decadent existence. You know, just like alone in a room, you know, drinking alcohol. A shivering denizen of alcohol's mad realm. I understand what that was like. But in the earlier days, you know, there was some fun to be had, and then there was a lot of trouble. Now, I started drinking probably in, you know, 1969, 1970. So a lot of my early drinking happened in the 70s. So, you know, in the 1970s was a wild time. It kind of was the Wild West back then because you could get away with a lot more than you can get away with today. I mean, there's video all over the place today, and, you know, the police know, like, a lot. And, you know, back in the 70s, nobody knew what the hell we were doing. We were just these long-haired, wild kids that were very strange. But there was a lot of stuff going on in the 70s. Now, I lived in a town called Basking Ridge, New Jersey, and it was about 40 minutes outside of New York City. Now, this was a really, really cool place to live because on the weekends, we would go into New York City and we saw some of the best bands. There was always something to do. And you know, we went in there a lot. Now I've got to tell you, I did really, really stupid things when I was drinking. You know, you ever come out of a blackout, you know, or you show up back at work the next morning after like a Christmas party or something, and you don't really, it's like hazy recollections. You don't really remember what the heck went on, and somebody wants to tell you about the stupid stuff that you did. You're like, no, please, just don't tell me. just don't tell me whatever you do. But I did a lot of stupid things when I was drinking. And one of the stupid things that I would do is every once in a while someone would offer drugs. Here I am drunk out of my mind. Yeah, sure. And that could cause extra problems. I'll tell you about this one time. I'm at a Foghat Wishbone Ash concert in New York City. I mean, that's how long ago this is, right? And, you know, we're good and drunk because, you know, you drink on the way in. I don't know that I remember many of the concerts I went to, but my buddy John comes up to me and he just came back from the bathroom and he goes, hey man, they've got LSD. They're selling LSD in the bathroom, man. You want to go buy some? And, you know, he could have said just about anything. Yeah, sure. So we go into the bathroom and we buy LSD off of this guy. And we eat it. And then we go back down and we sit down in our chair for about 3 minutes. And then we look at each other and go, are you high? No, it's not working. Let's go back. We got ripped off. Let's go back and get more. So we go back and we buy more, and then, you know, 10 minutes goes by, and, you know, we must have got ripped off again. Let's go back. And so we go back and we buy. Now, this is like the last song of the show is playing, and we're like this. I mean, it's an ordeal, you know. It's an ordeal. We're like trying to hang on to sanity, you know. And, you know, it felt like somebody injected Fantasia into my eye with a turkey baster. You know what I mean? I'm like, whoa! And so the lights come on, and, you know, we're like, we know we got to leave. And so we're like walking. None of us are talking. You know, we're just able to hang on to sanity. And we came in a van, right? So we all pile into the van and we're all in like a fetal position, you know, just not talking, you know, and to get to New Jersey, I don't know if anybody's gone from New York to New Jersey, but you got to go through a tunnel, right? So, and it's like this: 8 lanes, 6 lanes, 4 lanes, 2 lanes, tunnel, and we're heading down to the tunnel, and somebody in the front of the van goes, "Hey man, we'll never fit, right?" And so some of us are concerned, right? You don't want to get stuck in a tunnel. So we're like moving forward in the van, and sure enough, that's a mouse hole. We aren't getting to there. You ever try to back out of the Lincoln Tunnel? Oh my God. I don't know how the drivers are out here in Akron, but there's some rude drivers in New York. So stupid stuff like this is happening. This is happening all the time. You know, this one time, I'm drunk, I'm in a blackout, and I call up my boss. You know how you get resentments, you know, when you're drinking. And I call up my boss and I threaten his life. I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill you. You know, and because it's a blackout, I don't remember. So, I walk into work the next day. And he's like, what are you doing here? What is wrong with you? Has anybody ever asked you that? What is wrong with you? And when I found out what was wrong with me? About six months in Alcoholics Anonymous when I started to write inventory. That's when I found out what was wrong with me. So I believe alcoholism is, at its root, it's spiritual. And the foundation comes from my world perspective on selfishness and self-centeredness. My whole perspective on life is shaded with selfishness and self-centeredness. I'm always deciding, like, what are you going to be able to do for me? How is this going to affect me? You know, oh, there's a funeral tomorrow. Somebody died on me. You know, now I gotta, you know, now I gotta get all dressed up. You know, I mean, I'm thinking about selfishly. And you know, and I believe that at heart I feel cut off from God, and I feel cut off from my relationships with you. And I think that started, I think I was born that way. You know, I think it started really, really early. But it creates this nightmare scenario where it's not comfortable being like that. It's not comfortable being that like that. And there's something that alcohol will do for me that will change the way I feel. So, you know, I believe at its best what Alcoholics Anonymous offers is it offers us a holistic solution to this sense of separation. And my first example of it was when I first showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I went to get my driver's license back for one of my, you know, DUIs. I had to go to outpatient, then I ended up in inpatient, and they exposed me to AA. That's back when a lot of the treatment centers would take you out to meetings, and so I knew a little bit about what it was and where it was. So things got bad enough, you know, that I'm gonna go to AA, right? It's bad enough. And so off I go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got to tell you, it was very, very difficult. My first several weeks in AA, it could have gone either way. Because it was just so uncomfortable for me to walk into a room full of people that I didn't really know. I had to really be desperate to do something like that. And I showed up in this group, and I started to get consistent with meetings. You know, they were saying, get consistent with meetings. And I did. There was a number of different home groups I belonged to in the early days. But looking back on this experience, looking back on the experience of showing up in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think one of the first lessons I got was coming back into community. You know, it was I felt separated from, I felt uncomfortable with community, but it really was a solution to my problem, and it was highly recommended by my sponsor and some other things to get consistent with meetings. So I did, and I started to come in until finally I felt comfortable in some of the groups that I was in. I made friends with people, and things started to get a little bit better. Now, I don't know about anybody else, but I have really been prey to this thing called resentment. I would remember perceived transgressions against me for like decades. I would never be able to forget that someone did me wrong or whatever, and I had monstrous, massive amounts of resentments. And to be able to deal with those, you know, just going to meetings was not going to cut it. As a matter of fact, I started to get resentful at some of the people in meetings. I don't know if that's ever happened to you. Have you ever been in a meeting? You know, it's a discussion meeting. You're sitting there, you're being a good AA, and all of a sudden you look over and it's, Oh no, he raised his hand. Oh no, oh my God, oh please don't let him, oh don't call on him, don't call, oh they called on him. Oh no, now, for the next 5 minutes, now we're gonna hear him share about his family. Oh geez, you know, buddy, tell somebody who cares. Oh, now he's grateful. Oh, that just warms my heart that he's grateful. I think I'll go outside and slash all four of his tires and then follow him out of the meeting just to see how his gratitude holds up, you know? Oh, oh, thank God, finally he's done, finally he's done. And, you know, you got to be a good Eddie. Hey, so you, thanks for sharing, you know. This is the stuff that's going through my head, you know, in my first 6 months in Alcoholics Anonymous, this toxic, toxic resentment. And I didn't feel like I could be honest with somebody about this. I can't tell them that's what I'm thinking. They'll throw a net over me, right? So I'm suffering from this. And today I understand just how toxic and corrosive this resentment is. Now, I also suffered from anxiety. You know, the book Alcoholics Anonymous talks a lot about fear. It's fear is an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence is shot through with it. And I get all that. I really do. I misunderstood the word fear when I read it in our literature. I thought it meant being a coward. I thought that if I admit that I have fear, then I'm admitting I'm a coward. And that's not really what they're talking about in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. They're talking about this, it's more like anxiety. It's just like not fitting in, not wanting to be here, not being comfortable. You know, I don't want to do that. I'll see you later. You know, that's like the fear that they're talking about. And I had tons of this. It was difficult for me for a long time. In New Jersey, I know there's around the country, there's clubhouses. In New Jersey, there's church basements. You know, that's where you go to AA. You go down the stairs into the church basement. And I had a really hard time getting out of my car, going over, walking through the door, walking down the stairs and walking into an AA meeting. And this lasted a long time. I just was not comfortable with it. And there was this debate in my mind every single time. You know, well, you know, there's something on TV tonight. You know, I can go tomorrow night. Well, no, you got to go to the meeting. And so I was continuing to force myself to go down into the meetings. Now, another thing that I suffered a lot from was my misunderstanding of my behavior, where it revolved around relationships. I used, you know, I'll give you, for instance, if you would have asked me, up until I wrote inventory, if you would have asked me, you know, well, what about that ex-wife that you had? I would say, she left me when I needed her most. You know what I mean? That's what she did. She left me when I needed her most. And then when I finally wrote inventory on it, she would have been crazy not to leave. You know? So this is a little bit about how I'm not really seeing things in a same way. And I didn't see things in the same way within relationships. A lot of times I expected you to read my mind or understand, you know, what I wanted from you, you know, and you were disloyal if you weren't paying attention to the things that I wanted. And there was all this stuff going on in my life. Now, if you're anything like that, what happens is your life gets smaller. Every month and every year that goes by, there is less people in your life because either you cut them out or they leave. And so I walk into, you know, before I show up in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's nobody left. All my friends are gone. My family's gone. You know, I'm drinking in a room, you know, by myself for years, really not interacting any more than I had to with the outside world. Now, I show up in Alcoholics Anonymous and, you know, there's a certain expected behavior if you show up in AA that if you violate it, it makes it very, very difficult for you to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, you know, I come in with all these broken tools as far as how to get along with somebody. And I'm having a real, real tough time, you know, making friends or getting close to anybody. Now, if you stay in that state, I'll liken it to untreated alcoholism. If If you remain in that state, it's going to be very, very difficult for you to stick out this Alcoholics Anonymous thing and stay sober. But what happened with me was I had made friends with this guy. Radio Shack Mike was his name. You know, everybody had nicknames back in the day. And Radio Shack Mike was one of these guys who would go off. He would go off to like the New Age bookstores, and you know, every week he had a new answer. You know, like one week it'd be Chris, pyramids, Chris, you gotta get a pyramid for your bed. You know, and the next week it'd be crystals. You know, you gotta get you some crystals. So he was very pious, and he always had all these crazy different answers. But this one day, he came up to me and he handed me a set of 8 90-minute cassette tapes. This is back prior to CDs. It was cassette land. And he said, you know, I didn't really care too much for this, but you're hardcore. You might like these. And I go, well, what are they? He goes, oh, they're a Big Book workshop. And I go, a Big Book workshop? I go, the book that they give you in treatment? You know, that's really what I knew about the Big Book. There weren't any Big Book meetings that I was going to. And I remember that they gave you this book, Alcoholics Anonymous in Treatment, and on your last day in treatment, you get everybody to sign it. You know, that's what you do with it. And you know, I'm like, Big Book? So I go looking for my Big Book, and I find my Big Book, and I open it up. And sure enough, there's all my buddies that I was going to stay in touch with the rest of my life, who I, you know, never heard from again, who had signed this book. And the first thing I read was, Chris, you crazy bastard, you're never going to make it. Love, Harry. You know, that was like one of the signatures in it. So this is what I know about the Big Book. So I go, you know, the Big Book, I don't understand. That's like an old book. And he goes, no, this is like a workshop. These guys from Arkansas go through this workshop. You know, you're hardcore. You might appreciate it. And so what I do is I start listening to these tapes. And, you know, the late, great Joe and Charlie, obviously. And absolutely. And, you know, what happened to me was I was trying to treat my alcoholism with attendance at meetings. I mean, that's really about all I was doing. And I was able to stay sober, but it was incredibly tenuous. It was, at any moment, you know, something could have gone wrong. And so I listened to these tapes. And the lesson in them was this. And I was not very happy hearing this lesson, but basically what I heard in these tapes was, Chris, if you're an alcoholic and you are not working a program as it's laid out in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, you don't have a program. And if you don't have a program, there's a real good chance you could drink. And, you know, I was very, very unhappy hearing that, because by this period of time, 6 months in, I'm going to meetings every night. I finally made some friends. And I thought I was doing my job, you know. So this was like not really welcome information. Now, I go through the whole set. And I've got to tell you, the information in there haunted me, because it spoke to alcoholism, and it spoke to a solution for alcoholism. And I didn't really understand either one of them, but Joe and Charlie spoke with such authenticity. They spoke with such confidence. You just knew that they believed what they were saying. And the information in this haunted me. Now, what happened to me was, just being a meeting maker, about 6 months, 9 months in, some things happened in my life. And there's a section in the book Alcoholics Anonymous that basically says, if your spiritual condition is not where it needs to be, you're not going to be able to handle the trials and low spots ahead. And I understand that today. What happened with me was I had met a little lady in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we had started dating. I don't recommend you know, dating somebody prior to doing a fourth step, because you don't even know who you are. You don't even know how you're going to show up. And that's basically what happened with me. And that didn't work out. And that was very, very difficult for me. I lost my job. It was an economic downturn, and I got laid off. So I had no job. I had no girlfriend. And I started to get letters from Florida with language like fleeing to avoid prosecution, you know, like details like that. I don't know. And it was all a lot for me. You know, I mean, you know, I was in really, really bad shape. And I remember going over to my sponsor's house and talking to him about it. And sponsors are funny. Like, you'll go to your sponsor with a very detail-oriented problem, and they'll laugh and they'll say, "Have you been to a meeting?" What? You know, so I remember I went over there and I detailed this whole thing out, and he laughed and he goes, "Have you prayed about it?" I'm like, were you listening, you know? And if you have a sponsor like that, that's a good sponsor, because what they're doing is they're not trying to help you manage an unmanageable life. They're not trying to manage your symptoms. They're trying to point you to the solution, which is the solution is a deep and effective relationship with God. And that's what my sponsor kept doing. He kept pointing me back to the solution. And, you know, I was feeling so bad. And the information on the Joe and Charlie tapes was haunting me. And it got to a point where what I basically did was I basically broke out my big book. I got a notebook. And I started to listen to the tapes. And I started to go through the tapes. And I started to make an attempt to actually, you know, work these steps. And, you know, my sobriety date is my sobriety date, but I believe I started to recover when the day that I put those tapes in the tape deck and had made a commitment to and a decision to go through these steps, and I actually started to go through them. Now, you know, what happened with me was I wasn't even recognizing it at the time, but the action of these particular steps, what they did was they started to heal my spirit. I believe many of us come in here and our spirit has been just crushed. Alcoholism just beats us down. And there needs to be a spiritual healing as well as a physical healing. And I believe that started to happen in my life. when you drink for two decades alcoholically, you cause a lot of damage. You cause damage to yourself. You cause damage to relationships. Again, I believe that selfishness and self-centeredness really is where our alcoholism, where my alcoholism starts. And I came in here not thinking I was selfish. I came in here not believing that. If you were to say, "Chris, you're really selfish," I would not have believed it. But when you look back at like the last 4 years of my drinking, what I would do is I would rush home from work, I would grab a bottle of booze, I would head to my room, and I would start drinking it, and the phone would be turned off, I wouldn't answer the mail, "Do not bother me, I'm drinking." And I believed that I wasn't hurting anybody but myself with this behavior. Now think about it, how selfish though is that? You've taken yourself off the playing field to be of any help to anybody. you know, when you're drinking like that. And, you know, I needed that relief. I'm going to tell a story that I believe is going to at least explain a little bit of my alcoholic problem, what really the problem was with me. I told you I would change my mind at work, and I would draw, you know, by the time work was over, I was heading to the liquor store. Now, I had a routine at the liquor store. I went to the same liquor store, I knew the proprietor, and if it was the warmer months, I would drink Gordon's vodka, and if it was the cooler months, I would drink George Dickel bourbon. Those were my drinks. And I knew where they were in the liquor store, and they knew not to run out because we had had that talk. So here's what would happen. I would come through the door of the liquor store. I'd have a 20 in my pocket. I knew where the bottle was. I'd grab the bottle. I'd get up to the cash register. I'd put the bottle and the 20 down. The guy would ring it up. He'd give me my change, drop the bottle in a paper bag, and I'm out, right? I'm out. I'm headed to the car. And just walking through the door on the way out, I'm feeling relief because I've got the bottle in my hand. Now, this one day, I walk in there. This is an uninterrupted routine for many years. One day, I walk in there, and I grab my bottle, and I'm headed to the cash register, and there's a woman asking, she's going to the guy behind the cash register. She's going, "Do you know what kind of wine goes with tilapia?" And I'm like, "What?" And he's going, "Oh, yeah, you know, there's the marvelous new vintage from the California region." And he's taking her around, and he's showing her all this wine. And I'm standing there with my 20 and my bottle, like, just horrified that this guy is, "Hey, vodka buyer here, you know? What is the matter with you, crazy?" And I started to freak out. I am freaking out. Like, "Ring me up! Ring me up! I got a problem here! I got a problem! I'm sober! You know? Hook me up, dude! Give that lady a bottle of Gallo and get her the hell out of here!" You know? So, you know, like, think about that. This is the internal distress I'm going through. And whether the alcohol is the answer to it or not, I think it is. And I'm absolutely out of my mind until I get it. Now, that really speaks to like an internal condition. There's something really, really wrong. Why do I need that alcohol? Why do I need that? Now, I believe that alcohol treated this spiritual condition that I had. It was the treatment for this spiritual condition. It's a bad treatment, but it was a treatment, and it treated this spiritual uncomfortability. I don't even know how to describe it. It's like the untreated alcoholism, the bondage of self it talks about in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And this alcohol treated it. You know, I've got to find something that's going to replace that alcohol. And for the longest time, I thought it was going to the AA meetings. And I'm a fellowship guy. I am absolutely consistent with meeting attendance. I've moved around the country. Andrea and I have moved around the country a bunch of times. And each time we do, I make it a point of, you know, going to a number of meetings and getting situated in those meetings because I know how important it is. But there's something deeper that I need for the healing to happen. And it's through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that I have found that. You know, today I believe I do have an awakened spirit due to the results of the 12 steps. Please do not mistake an awakened spirit for being a perfect person. You know, that's certainly not the case. I'm not. I don't even like perfect people, to tell you the truth, but. But I'm awake. I can recognize the truth of things today, And, you know, that's really, really good. You know, the last 10 years or so have been amazing in my life. Every positive thing that has happened to me, every single positive thing that's happened to me is a direct result of the gifts that have been given to me from Alcoholics Anonymous and my participation in that Alcoholics in the process of Alcoholics Anonymous. What it looked like in the late 80s was I was a bad electrician working for a really bad boss with a bad car and bad clothes and no money. It was just an absolute mess. Now, here's basically what happened over the course of the last 30 years. And I want you to understand this. This isn't something that I went after with a sense of virtue. It was something that I went after because of the sense of desperation that I had. The true understanding that alcohol is right around the corner and can pick me off. But what I've done is I've participated in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now here's the funny thing. When you do a fourth step and you do a resentment inventory and you share that with a sponsor and then you become willing to have God remove that defect of character and humbly ask God to remove that defect of character and then become willing to make amends where these resentments have caused harm and actually go out and make amends where these resentments have caused harm, what happens is there's not only healing of relationships, but there's a healing inside. There's a shift in perception. You no longer feel like it's a hostile universe coming at you. In other words, you do enough of the four-step inventory, and you'll go from thinking your problems are coming at you to understanding that your problems are coming from you. And that's like a huge shift in perception. Now, when you had the type of anxiety that I had that impacted every area of my life, I just wouldn't, not only would I not show up, I wouldn't try. I'm not gonna go off to college. What if I fail? I'm not gonna try to get that job. What if I look stupid? I mean, a million things like that impact my quality of life and did impact my quality of life. And when you do a fear inventory and you share it with a sponsor, you become willing to have God remove that defective character. You humbly ask God to remove that defective character. You become willing to make amends where that fear impacted other people and institutions, and you actually go out and make amends where that fear impacted other people and institutions. You start to outgrow fear and you start to say, okay, I'm going to give it a shot. What's the worst that can happen? I'm in. And when you're really bad at relationships because you're looking at them with the most selfish pair of glasses you can possibly use, and you do a sex inventory and you share it with a sponsor and you become willing to have God remove those defects of character and you humbly ask God to remove those defects of character, then you become willing to make amends where your behavior has caused harm and you actually go out and make amends where those behaviors have caused harm, what happens is there's an enormous amount of healing in your ability to have effective and meaningful relationships. Now, I didn't do all this stuff for that reason. I did it because I thought you needed to do it to be able to stay separated from alcohol. And that's certainly part of the truth. But some of the benefit has changed me. And I went from a person who was a bad electrician, you know, working for a drunken contractor, to some different kind of work. So I got into facilities management work. And because I was attempting to be honest in all my affairs, and because I started to become responsible about showing up on time and saying what I was going to do and then doing what I say I was going to do, some things really started to change in my life, and I started to get promoted. So I ended up doing a lot of different jobs, running facilities departments for school systems, running facilities departments for pharmaceutical manufacturing and research and development sites, just stuff that I never could have believed I could have done. Even while I was doing them, I was always thinking, you know, if these people only knew, you know, like what a screw up I've been in the past, they would never give me the keys to this thing. And so that's really gone well. Because I've learned some of the skills in relationships, and it has a lot to do with honesty and integrity and all the things that you get taught in here, I've been able to develop some really good friendships and put together a wonderful marriage, which is, you know, I wasn't capable of any of those things prior to getting into Alcoholics Anonymous. And it all boils down to these spiritual exercises and the spiritual experience that you get from them, and a deep and abiding relationship with God. You know, some of the amazing promises in Alcoholics Anonymous, now get this, one of the promises in Alcoholics Anonymous is God will do for you what you cannot do for yourself. And I think sometimes I take that promise for granted. What they're basically saying is you can gain access to the actual power of God, and that power will work in you and through you and give you the ability to do what you could not do on your own. Folks, I don't even know if they promise that at church. That's an amazing promise. And it's absolutely been true in my life. Now, I'm going to tell one story and I'm going to sit down. I said that I got to a point where I was running the facilities programs for pharmaceutical manufacturing sites. I want to tell you a story about what happened at a site that I was working at. Now, understand that the pharmaceutical industry itself is very regulated. They have standard operating procedures, they have checklists, they have quality control people, they have quality assurance departments, and every single step in the manufacturing of a pharmaceutical product is checked and double-checked, validated 5 ways from Sunday, because they have to be absolutely sure that the products they're making are absolutely perfect. They're qualified products, and they're absolutely perfect. Now I'm running a maintenance department in this manufacturing plant. And here's basically what happened. There's an assembly line where the pharmaceutical tablets drop down through a hopper and get put into the pill bottles, right? And so there's this big hopper, and there's a top to the hopper. Now, we find out later what happened was the top to the hopper fell off, broke, and they didn't have another one. Now, you have to understand, every single one of these machines is validated by engineering departments. Every nut, every bolt has to be approved by engineers. Well, they've got to find another top. They can't shut this assembly line down, you know, forever, and they find out that to order one of these tops, it's like 6 weeks out. So one of the maintenance guys goes, I can make a top. And he takes some plexiglass and he cuts some plexiglass and he makes a top and he puts it on there. Now it's a couple of days later and the QA department is going through with their checklist and somebody looks up and goes, what the hell is that? That doesn't look like the right top. And the whole packaging department stops. And there's an investigation, you know, everyone descends on this place. What the hell could have happened? What's with that top? And the investigation leads to this guy who made a top for it. Now what they have to do is they have to absolutely verify and prove that different top could not have affected the quality of the medication. And that took like a couple of weeks. I mean, they had to do all these studies. They had to absolutely prove that a different top couldn't have affected the medication because it was all put on hold until that happened. Now, you know, why do I tell that story? That medication was life-saving medication. We want that to be perfect, right? We want to understand how it's made. We want to make sure that it's the same way every time because we want the positive outcome of that medication. Somebody screws it up somewhere and you could kill people. Now, here's the thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't have a quality assurance department. We don't have QA people running around. You know, we're not going to stop the meeting because somebody shares something weird. We're very, very open, and the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous are wide open, and I think they need to be. But absolutely. But what we do have is we do have an SOP manual. It's called the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And as a sponsor, I believe it's important for me to operate as closely to the directives in that book as possible so that I don't go, you know, I don't just come up with Chris's program. You know, you would not want Chris's program. So, you know, I'm a big book guy. I don't apologize for that. I've found so much truth. You know, I truly believe today that the big book was a download. It was a spiritual download. And the people that were putting it together, Bill especially, were inspired. Because there's so much truth in this book. There's so much power. And I have found every single year I look at that book, I can gain more and more perspective of it. You know, I am really, really grateful. This is such an honor to be able to come out to Founders Day and participate in it. You know, Jeff, I want to thank you again for asking me to come here. And everybody, have a really good time here. Take care.